Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Stephen Crane about his book, The Emergence of Meaning, in which he lays out the theoretical and experimental case for logical nativism, the idea that aspects of the logical system are innately given. In this interview, we discuss the relation of this idea to Chomsky's concept of innateness in universal grammar, and we explore the relevance of cross-linguistic findings to these claims of universality. We also discuss the implications of these results for studies of language impairments cross-linguistically. I'm pleased to welcome Professor Stephen Crane to talk about his new book, The Emergence of Meaning, in which he offers a theoretical and experimental perspective on the nature of human logical competencies. Stephen, how did this book come about?
Well, I had been working on Noam Chomsky's theory of universal grammar for many years, and I was focusing on children's acquisition of syntax. I wrote an article in 1990 called Language Acquisition in the Absence of Experience, and it was a sort of a summary of all the work that I had been doing with my colleagues and students up to that point on the acquisition of syntax. And it was an article that tried to make the point that children knew a lot more than they could have learned based on their experience. So in some sense, it was a defense of Chomsky's nativist position. Well, after that, I felt like I needed to move in a new direction. And I started to think about my earlier career, where I had studied logic at UCLA in the United States, and I had a philosophy background. And so I thought, well, I want to see if the same sorts of arguments that we made for the acquisition of syntax might also be made for the acquisition of logical reasoning in children. And when I was a student at UCLA, I studied with Richard Montague, among others, and he taught us how to translate English into formal logic, first-order logic, and he also taught us how to translate logical formulas into English sentences. And so I took that approach in this book of trying to see whether we couldn't make an argument that a lot of what children knew about logic was embedded in their language, and that a lot of it would be developed in children in the absence of experience. So it was really a combination of the influence of Noam Chomsky and the influence of logicians on my thinking. And I wanted to bring the two strands of my thinking together. So I formulated this book. I had been working with a number of colleagues and students on some of these logical words like disjunction, or in English, ka in Japanese, hoja in Mandarin Chinese. I had been working on them, but I hadn't really put it all together. A friend of mine who's recently departed, Roger Wales, encouraged me to put all of this together in a single book, and I took him up on that, and this is sort of the result of his inspiration as well.
As you say, the main thrust of the argument that you put forward in the book is to defend this idea of logical nativism. Could you tell us a little about how that relates to the, or how you see that relating to the concept of nativism in grammar?
Yes. Well, another question that always comes up when I give talks is, what is the relationship between language and logic? Is there more to language than just logical reasoning? Does language enable us to reason logically? And what I thought was, I would like to see whether the same sorts of arguments that have been made about grammar, about syntax in particular, couldn't be extended to logical reasoning. The relationship is still a little bit unclear to me. I do believe that logic is the basis of human language, and that all human languages share or draw upon a common core of logical concepts, that the grammar itself is what enables us to put those logical concepts together. So there's an intimate relationship between the grammar, which is a recursive device that enables us to generate new sentences and understand sentences that we've never experienced before, and our ability to reason logically. So they're intimately intertwined, in my own view. And the same sorts of arguments for syntactic nativism can, in fact, be extended to logical nativism, which is what I attempt to do in the book.
Yes, one aspect I was quite interested in just from a theoretical perspective is that if from a traditional Chomskyan point of view, we've often heard about the idea of innately given capabilities that are specific to language. And various theories, of course, posit things that are more or less necessarily specific. Do you see the kinds of abilities that you propose under the rubric of logical nativism being something that's specific to language, or rather something that can be observed through the prism of language, but which is maybe more general to cognition?
That's a very important question, and I have a particular perspective on the question, but of course it's an empirical question, and I could be wrong on it. But I do believe, in fact, that some of these logical abilities that I describe in the book are specific to language and are not just the consequences of a rational being. So at one point in the book, I consider this in some detail, whether or not these principles of logic are just principles of rationality, such that if you had a very intelligent chimpanzee, would they, you know, because they would be rational, would they develop this sort of logical reasoning system that humans have developed or have evolved in humans, and that are described as I go through the book for two languages, Mandarin Chinese and English. And I've reached the conclusion, I tried to make the arguments in the book, but as I say, these are just arguments, and this is an empirical question, and a very important empirical question. I try to make the argument that if a chimpanzee is really smart and learns to sign, they might not learn the same logical principles that humans that have evolved in humans on the basis of having a language faculty. So my own view is that logical reasoning in these basic logical concepts and the ability to put them together is specific to language and doesn't follow from general cognitive principles.
There's this observation that it's in some sense curious that logic works in reality. It's curious that mathematics works in reality as well as just being an axiomatic system that makes sense. It's presumably highly adaptive to have a predisposition to be able to acquire logical deductions. I wondered whether you felt it was in some sense easier to make a direct case for the development of logic than it is necessarily to make the case on evolutionary grounds for the development of the kind of complex linguistic abilities that have been posited in various different incarnations of UG.
It's difficult for me to answer that question. I tend to avoid questions of evolution because we know so little about how language evolved and it's so controversial. So Chomsky's own position is that language evolved in a single mutation about 100,000 years ago, perhaps double that, but still very recently. If that's true, and it didn't evolve slowly over time, it evolved in a single mutation in a group of people, a tribe, if you will, that were living at the time in East Africa and then spread throughout the world, then there can't be a sort of separation of, well, it makes sense for logic to have evolved in a single mutation, but it makes less sense for grammar to evolve in a single mutation. As you say, if grammar and logic are intimately intertwined, as I believe they are, then it's hard to say that the grammatical principles are less likely to have evolved than the logical principles. So that's a difficult question. It might be an easier question if Chomsky's wrong and if language evolved slowly over time. But if he's right, then it will be hard to make the case that it was sort of more advantageous to the species to develop logic than it would be to develop grammatical principles. If you think about Chomsky's recent minimalist program, where the human language faculty evolves in a way that is optimal for what language is used for, it's used to take meanings and then to externalize those meanings using sign or using our vocal cords, so producing words into sentences. If you take that perspective that it's an optimal system, then, of course, logic is an optimal system in some sense as well, in the sense that, you know, we can do so much with it. Now, again, maybe it didn't evolve. Either system didn't evolve for a particular function, but when it did evolve, we could put it to work, and it does accomplish a great deal, and we are able to use it in order to both communicate and to perform deductive reasoning tasks. So this is a very deep and tricky question, and I certainly am one of the last people to have written about this, because I think it's really premature and we don't have the accurate records to go back in time to see how things evolved, whether they actually evolved in a single mutation or more slowly. I tend to think that that Chomsky's position is on the right track, but that's probably because, you know, he's someone that I admire greatly and have been greatly influenced by.
As you bring up minimalism, I mean, I guess I have the sense that there's a trajectory in the theoretical literature and in the views that Chomsky, for example, has expressed over the years towards a narrower faculty of language, a narrower UG, and in some sense a claims for the constituents of UG that are not quite so, don't appear to be quite so intimately tied to language as we kind of analyze it as linguists. And in that sense, I wondered whether you feel there's a convergence between that line of thinking and a view that gives logic, this somewhat abstract system, quite a prominent place in the set of linguistically relevant abilities.
I do think that. Again, it's not something, I mean, we're speculating on relationships between logic and language that we can't actually prove. But if one wants to speculate about it, I would suggest that the basic combinatorics of human language are just the thing that would be used to combine logical operators and to formulate expanded logical sentences and to perform logical tasks. So we have to have some sort of combinatory operations like merge and so on to combine words together. And it may be that those same basic operations, these core operations that are in the narrow syntax, are exactly what would be used to combine logical operators together and to formulate more extensive logical reasoning formulas and so on. So I believe that There's no tension between the minimalist program and the idea of a narrow syntax that has these combinatorics and the idea that the grammar, the recursive grammar in the narrow syntax, can be used to perform tasks that involve logical reasoning.
No, indeed. I'd like to take a step back, if I may, and ask, at various points in the book, you oppose the logically nativist position that you're espousing to views of logical competence that are, in some sense, emergentist.
Could you characterize the sort of fundamental differences between the view that you're espousing and the view which says that logical competence can be learned from experience?
Well, I think that if logical competence could be learned from experience, then we have to have some kind of learning mechanism or parsing mechanism that has the character that will enable it to put experience to work in exactly the way that it works in human languages. In the book, what I do in order to show that experience is not directly relevant, or at least to argue that it might not be directly relevant, is to show that the same principles arise in two historically unrelated languages. Clearly, the experience of children in who speak Mandarin Chinese in Beijing and the experiences of children raised in Sydney, Australia, or in Munich, Germany, will be quite different. So if it turns out that the same principles are acquired, then either these learning mechanisms are the same and are, you know, ideally suited to taking various experiences and putting them together in the same way, or there is a specific contingent language faculty that does this for the child. And I think the weight of the evidence suggests that, you know, since no one has proposed such learning mechanisms or a parser that can put things together in Mandarin Chinese and in German and in English in exactly the right way to give these abilities to children to reason logically, then the burden of proof is on the experience-based person to argue that there are such learning mechanisms. In the absence of any coherent argument that there are such learning mechanisms, I think it makes sense to, at least initially, to adopt the idea that maybe these mechanisms are specific to the human species, and that's why when we have different experiences, we nevertheless develop the same systems for reasoning logically.
Do you feel that it's something that the emergentist position has neglected because it's too complicated, or they don't have a story about it? Or do you feel it's something that has attracted insufficient attention generally because people don't realize that there's something to explain here?
I do think that the emergentists and the constructivists and so on have ignored cross-linguistic generalizations. And what I try to show in the book that these cross-linguistic generalizations include a lot about first-order logic. So I've tried to extend the sort of database that needs to be explained and try to pose these as problems for alternative approaches, for the non-nativist approaches. So I agree with you that, or maybe it's not your position, but it's a position that you've characterized, that a lot of emergentist proposals and non-nativist proposals have simply ignored a lot of the basic cross-linguistic work. And it is really incumbent on them to take some of these arguments seriously, because they're very powerful arguments. If children learning Mandarin Chinese and children learning German and children learning English are coming up with reaching the same conclusions on the basis of very different linguistic structures, very different languages, very varied linguistic experiences, then this is fodder for the mill of the logical nativist. And I would like to see more attention being paid by emergentists and constructivists to cross-linguistic generalizations. At the moment, they're pretty much ignored. They do gesture towards certain sort of biological common properties, and that harks back again to the idea that any rational creature would develop these things. And so I've taken that on in a sort of separate argument. But my basic contention is that these cross-linguistic, you know, the fact that logical reasoning is pretty much the same for a lot of different structures in Mandarin Chinese and in English, despite the variation in experience for children, is something that needs to be taken very seriously. And I would suggest that it's been largely ignored by the emergentists, and it's really important. But to the extent that lots and lots of historically unrelated languages behave in the same way, it's going to be difficult to write a parser or to come up with a learning mechanism that has the character that will enable it to handle the fact that languages often reach the same conclusions about logical deductions, despite all the differences that appear on the surface of languages, all the word order differences and the structural differences, like in case marking and in agreement and tense. You know, some languages like English and German have full embodied tense and agreement systems, whereas languages like Mandarin Chinese lack tense and agreement altogether and have a well-developed aspectual system. So despite all of these differences that children are experiencing when they're learning their language, the fact that children reach the same conclusions about how logical words operate, what their basic meanings are, and how they combine, would suggest that there's a specialized mechanism for this, and it's not just a fact that emerges in different human languages, or so it seems to me.
Yeah. A particular focus of the work that you present in this book is your work on child language acquisition, also cross-linguistically. You've been instrumental in obtaining the data that bear upon these theories about innate knowledge. Would it be fair to say that acquisition is maybe the crucial testbed for the competing theories, in as much as we have competing theories?
Yes, I think it's one of the critical test beds. It's because when you study child language, children's experience has been compressed. So the learning problem is massive for children. How could they develop these abilities to reason logically by the age of 3 or 4 when they've had so little experience? Why is it that children learning different languages, another question, why is it that children learning different languages reach the same conclusions, even though the languages are different and their experience is different? And why do children differ in their reasoning abilities from adults sometimes? Sometimes adults have different logical reasoning abilities than children do. It's different on the surface. Of course, I argue that basically both children and adults are using the same mechanisms. But there are things that characterize different languages that are superimposed on logical reasoning and make it look like adults are speaking illogically when children are speaking logically, or vice versa. In any event, the differences between children's use of logical words and adult uses of logical words does show that children are learning their logical words, the meanings of words, or how to combine them on the basis of their experience, or they're not just watching adults use these logical words and then copying them, trying to mimic what adults do.
You have an interesting example on the acquisition of disjunction, acquisition of the term or in English, where we talk about it in terms of the problem of no negative evidence, in as much as there's an ambiguity in the interpretation of or. Could you tell us more about that?
I think the interesting finding is that when you look at adult languages, they look quite different. So it looks like adults are interpreting sentences with or differently across languages. So let me give you an example. In English, if I say Ted didn't order sushi or pasta for lunch, then that means he didn't order either one. He didn't order sushi for lunch, and he didn't order pasta for lunch. But if we translate that sentence into Russian or into Mandarin Chinese or into Japanese, it doesn't have the same meaning. So in Mandarin Chinese, Ted didn't order sushi or pasta for lunch will mean it's sushi that Ted didn't order, or it's pasta that Ted didn't order. So he might not have ordered one of them, and he could have ordered the other one. Quite different meaning for adult speakers when they use or in a negative statement. But when we look at children all come up with the same hypothesis. They all reach the conclusion that when you say Ted didn't order sushi or pasta for lunch, that means what it means for English-speaking adults. Ted didn't order sushi and pasta, and he didn't order pasta, so he didn't order either of those dishes. Mandarin-speaking children come up with the English-speaking hypothesis, and they don't come up with a hypothesis, or they don't come up with the interpretation that's used by Mandarin-speaking adults. Now, that doesn't mean that English is, more logical and that all children start off being logical and learning English, because I have exactly the opposite conclusion about negative sentences with and. So negative sentences with and, I argue that English-speaking children initially start off speaking Mandarin Chinese in interpreting negative sentences with and. So there's no more logical language. One language is not more logical than the other, and I don't want this book to be used by people to argue that, you know, English or Mandarin Chinese are more logical. The conclusion that I've reached is just the opposite, that all languages draw upon the same logical structures, and they combine them in exactly the same way. Now, there will be differences, as we've just seen. There will be differences between Mandarin-speaking children and Mandarin-speaking adults. But those differences are to be expected when we're dealing with logical operators, because logical operators, when they combine, can combine in different scope relations. So one of the main arguments that I make in the book is that just these simple scope differences are enough to account for the differences across human languages. The scope differences are something that are independently motivated. We need them anyway just to understand simple sentences. Like if I go to I went to Boston Logan Airport one time, and I was taking my pet. I was trying to deliver my pet from the United States to Australia when we moved here. And I noticed a sign that said, "All airplanes do not carry pets." Well, that has two logical operators, all and not, and all airplanes do not carry pets is ambiguous because it has two logical operators. So it could mean that no airplane carries pets, all airplanes do not carry pets, could mean that none of them do, or it could mean that not all airplanes carry pets, but some of them do. And of course, that's the intended interpretation. But there are two interpretations, and this is what happens typically when you have two logical operators. What I argue in the book is that this is exactly what happens in cases of disjunction, the or, not or. Ted didn't order sushi or pasta. Sometimes in human languages, the or is interpreted within the scope of negation, and that gives rise to the neither interpretation. Ted ordered neither sushi nor pasta. But on occasion, in Mandarin and in Russian and in lots of the world's languages, Japanese, for instance, or, the word or, ka in Japanese or huoja in Mandarin Chinese, that's the word that takes widest scope. And you get the interpretation that would result in a sort of cleft structure in English. It's sushi or pasta that Ted didn't order for lunch. So this cleft structure in English where we pronounce the disjunction first, it's sushi or pasta that Ted didn't order, that's how Mandarin works, and that's how Japanese works. On the surface, it looks the same as in English, where the or is on the surface appears, you know, inside the scope of negation. But at the level of interpretation, it looks as though Mandarin and Japanese and Russian and other languages are interpreting it as though the word for disjunction, or in English, takes scope over the word for negation. So by invoking this idea of scope, it may not be right, but it's the idea that I pushed in the book, we can explain the cross-linguistic differences. And again, this is a mechanism that we need independently. So it's not like I've advanced peculiar or idiosyncratic mechanism to explain cross-linguistic differences. I'm trying to explain cross-linguistic differences using the necessary tools that we already have at our disposal.
Yeah, in particular, you're offering in Chapter 4 a parametric account of scope in which in which you posit that parameters govern separately the scopal relation between negation and disjunction, and that between negation and conjunction. These are potential parameters in something like a principles and parameters sense. Is that correct?
That's right. Let me explain a little bit more about parameters. I'm using parameters very loosely in Chapter 4. It doesn't mean that these parameters are basically semantic parameters. It could be that they're the semantic reflex of a syntactic parameter. It could be that there's something about the syntax of Mandarin Chinese that causes disjunction to be interpreted outside the scope of negation. And it could be that there's something different about the syntax of English that causes disjunction to be interpreted within the scope of negation. So these cross-linguistic differences could result from syntactic parameters, and yet we see the interpretive consequences of these are what I'm trying to bring out. So as a consequence of whatever the parameter is, whatever the mechanism is, it turns out that the interpretation of disjunction in negative sentences is different in Mandarin Chinese as compared to English. So it is a parameter, no doubt, but I haven't spelled out exactly what the nature of the parameter is. I've just used the word parameter very generally to mean there's cross-linguistic variation, and the variation, whatever its origin, it results in interpretive differences. So it's semantic in some sense, but it's semantic, it could be just a semantic reflex. So I'm not really committed to there being semantic parameters. It could be that these parameters fit very nicely within the principles and parameters framework that's been developed by Noam Chomsky and lots of people in the generative tradition in recent years. So the answer, the simple answer is yes, you're right. I do see this as falling within these proposals as falling within the principles and parameters framework. But the point of my work that I report in the book is not to go into the details of what the parameter consists in, but rather what its consequences are for the interpretation of sentences in different human languages.
Sure. So one way of interpreting the concept of parameters here would be to say that we're innately disposed, possibly mediated by some other factors, to assign scope consistently to disjunction over negation or vice versa in a given language.
That's right.
In the experimental chapters of the book, as you say, you make comparisons in particular between findings from English and those from Mandarin, in particular those similarities which you argue can be adduced as support for nativism. Was there a particular reason why you focus on these two languages?
Just two reasons. First, they're historically unrelated. So if the same logical properties emerge or are characterized in these two languages, then that would be a strong argument for logical nativism because of their typologically distinct. And I think more and more research will confirm that typologically distinct languages can adopt the same logical mechanisms. But the second reason is that when we move to Australia, we're closer to China, and a lot of students from China have applied to do their research, their PhD research with me. And so I've naturally, you know, I do write some papers alone, and I wrote this book alone. But often when I write or work on a problem, I often work on it with a particular student or colleague, and hopefully my students become my colleagues, and we continue to work together on these in these areas and on these interesting puzzles. So I tend to focus on things that my students and my colleagues are interested in, not just what I'm interested in. When I came to Australia, I didn't have any students. No students from the United States came with me. So I had a little bit of time to think myself. And I think that this book sort of represents a lot of the thinking that I did when before I had students. But as soon as I had students, I could put my what I was thinking about into operation. I began to do studies on Mandarin Chinese. I found it very interesting. And I spend a lot of time in China. In fact, I'm the director of a center in Beijing, and I spend a lot of time thinking about Mandarin Chinese as well as English. And those are just the languages that I have available to me. If I was in Germany, then I would be working on the relationship between German and English, I'm sure, and my students would be posing problems, and I would be helping them try to solve those problems. They would be different problems. So some of it's just a matter of circumstance and accident of where I relocated, and some of it is because I wanted to look at languages that are typologically distinct in order to make the logical nativist argument.
Of course. A point you bring up is that there are also pragmatic factors that bear upon the way in which particularly logical operators interact with other logical operators, for example, disjunction and conjunction interacting with negation. Is that a similar story in Mandarin, or does the sort of landscape of possible expressions lead to different pragmatic consequences, or do we just not really know at this stage?
It's interesting that you raise this question, because it's something that's on my mind quite a lot. It seems that some of these pragmatic principles operate slightly differently across languages. I probably would not have expected that to be the case. I would have probably expected these pragmatic principles, these conversational principles, to be universal as well. But you know, what one expects and how life turns out are often quite different. So let me give you just one example. And it's something that I think shows you the differences. I won't go into the details of the pragmatic principles, but I'll give you the example. Anyway, if I say to you, every child brought a dog or a cat to the park. Every child brought a dog or a cat to the park. If you're a speaker of German or a speaker of English, I believe you think that at least some children brought dogs and some children brought cats. It's not that that means every child brought a dog to the park or every child brought a cat to the park, so they all brought the same thing to the park. For English speakers, and I think this is probably true of German speakers, every child brought a dog or a cat. There must be at least one dog, or maybe many more, or at least one, and at least one cat, and maybe many more. But when you translate that sentence into Mandarin Chinese, it really does mean every child brought the same thing. They either all brought a dog, or they all brought a cat. And it turns out that that interpretation is also the interpretation that Italian adults assign to the sentences. Now, that's supposed to be, in English, a pragmatic account of why we require some children at least to bring one pet or the and other children to bring the other. So at least one cat and one dog should be brought to the park for English speakers, and I believe for German speakers. But whatever that pragmatic principle is, it doesn't seem to be operative in Italian or in Mandarin Chinese. And that's quite a puzzle, because if these principles of pragmatics are universal, you wouldn't expect that. So there are nuances even in these pragmatic principles. Now, I don't study this in detail in the book, but it is interesting that you raise this question, because I do believe that that sentences with logical operators, even when they're influenced by pragmatics, can be interpreted quite differently in different languages. Now, another important point to add is that English-speaking children, we found in 1994, in some research that I did, I found that English-speaking children had the interpretation that I later discovered was characteristic of Mandarin Chinese and Italian. So I called them egalitarian children. So I found some English-speaking children who preferred to interpret every child brought a dog or a cat to the park as meaning they all brought dogs or they all brought cats, and it wouldn't be true if some brought dogs and some brought cats. I found that that was true of English-speaking children as well as Mandarin-speaking adults and Italian-speaking adults. So here again, we have an example of where English-speaking children look as though they're speaking a different language or have a different pragmatic operating principle. They're not learning their interpretation of this sentence based on English-speaking adults, because English-speaking adults don't have that interpretation. So there are morals here, and they support logical nativism and not the experience-based approach.
I guess this also goes to some extent to the question of what extent we can achieve translation equivalence, because I suppose a strong logical nativist position would be that, a la Montague, we really ought to be able to translate sentences, at least on that, in a way that's semantically consistent, but nevertheless the pragmatics may be different. Presumably your view would be that we need to appeal to pragmatics to explain the differences, and there is some sense of core meaning that's being maintained or can be maintained across translation. Is that fair?
It's fair as far as it goes, but it's not just pragmatic differences, because I think there are differences in focus. There are differences in, positive polarity item, polarity sensitivity. There are particular linguistic structures that are possible in different human languages. So there are differences in the syntactic domain as well. So the differences across languages are not merely in the pragmatic domain, but they extend to phonology and they extend to syntax as well. But once we understand what those differences are, we can neutralize them. We can try to show that if we can set those differences aside, then there will be common core properties that are characteristic of all human languages. So I tried to do that in the chapter on focus operators, for instance. So I show that, in English, the focus operator only, if you say only John ate rice or beans, then that means John ate rice or beans, but nobody else ate either one. So nobody else ate rice and nobody else ate beans. Everybody else who's being contrasted with John didn't eat rice and they didn't eat beans. Well, when focus operators, when disjunction appears in the scope of a focus operator, then in all human languages, then they are interpreted, disjunction is interpreted in the same way. So we can use these cross-linguistic differences to show, to reveal the common properties of human languages. So the cross-linguistic differences could give rise to different interpretations, but they can also be used to neutralize those different interpretations. Again, this would be evidence that human languages are drawing on the same basic, parts list of logical concepts and combining them in the same ways, subject, modulo these differences, which could be in the pragmatic system, could be in the phonological system, and they also could be in the syntactic system.
It certainly gives us an impression of how complex everything becomes when all these systems are apparently interacting in a very meaningful way. What do you see as the most important research directions in this particular field going forward?
What I'd like to see is more cross-linguistic research. I'd like to see more work in typologically distinct languages. Obviously, the predictions of this nativist theory, this logical nativist proposal, are that we're going to see even typologically distinct languages like Turkish and Mandarin Chinese look the same as long as we can investigate them in detail and as long as we're aware of these phonological, syntactic, and pragmatic differences. In fact, I try to neutralize the pragmatic differences as much as I can, and that's why I focus on so-called downward entailing linguistic environments. I'm trying to not allow the sentences to give rise to certain pragmatic implicatures, if you will. So I'm actually trying to show the cases where the pragmatic differences have been eliminated or at least controlled for. But I think my work will be vindicated or disconfirmed as we try to apply this to more and more languages, because languages have all of these complex properties that you mentioned, and it's amazing how languages can differ. And of course, the proposals that I make are tentative, and they need to be elaborated. it's not going to turn out to be exactly true that every human language will differ in only the ways that English and Mandarin differ. And so it won't be true that it'll be easy to show that these logical universals hold in, you know, quite distinct languages like Basque or Turkish or, you know, Navajo or Mohawk or some Aboriginal languages of Australia. We're going to see cross-linguistic differences. But the point is that if we can understand these cross-linguistic differences and we can try to deal with them, to neutralize them, then we're going to see the core properties emerge again and again in different human languages.
What do you see as the ultimate goal of the theory? I'm curious because we talked a little earlier about how the emergentist approaches are may be inadequate and don't seem to spell out very full or coherent theories, but at the same time, my impression is that they're striving for a level of granularity of explanation, ultimately, which is not necessarily considered desirable or possible within linguistics in a generative framework. I wonder where you would draw the line. How far down can we go?
It's important to point out that no logical nativist or no nativist would claim that children don't use experience as the basis of the foundation of their language. After all, you know, children raised in Sydney, Australia are learning English, and children raised in Beijing are learning Mandarin Chinese. But what we are attempting to do is to show the sort of common properties. Now, there is no proof that in the future, the emergentists and the constructivists won't come up with a theory that is a viable contender, that can actually explain a lot of the same phenomena that's explained within the generative tradition by the kinds of mechanisms that are described by in Noam Chomsky's work or presented in the book or described by work by Gennaro Kirkia and others in formal semantics. We can't prove that that our approach is better, but what we can do is to show how successful this approach is in describing, in coming up with cross-linguistic generalizations. And so I think that what I see in the future is that it's important to continue this line of work, as I said before, to study more and more languages and to come to grips with the common properties and not just the differences. Within the area of linguistic typology, there's a great sort of debate going on about whether how much languages can differ. And we know that they do differ. I mean, you and I both speak English, but our dialects are quite distinct, and my dialect is quite distinct from my wife's dialect because she's from New Zealand. But if we try to look at in depth at the common properties and what characterizes all human languages, then I think it's going to drive a further wedge between the emergentist and the constructivist approach and this nativist approach. And that's really my goal, is to see which one is closer to the truth. We can, and I think in where the differences will be greatest is in the ability of the people who believe in universal grammar to actually describe what happens in typologically distinct languages. And to the extent that the emergentists and the experience-based approaches fail to even come to grips with historically unrelated languages, fail to take these linguistic generalizations to heart and try to explain them using the mechanisms that they're proposing, then they'll fall behind. So I think that if the challenge is to see which particular theoretical perspective is closer to the truth, then I'm going to put my money on cross-linguistic research and the common properties as showing that the nativist approach is superior, is going to be closer to the truth ultimately. But that said, I hope you took my words to heart, that I understand that once we start looking at different languages, you know, it's not going to be as simple as I might have made it appear to be in the book, where we can just look at all languages and we can easily see the common properties emerge if we just do some clever experiments.
Sure. No, I think nobody's under any illusions as to how complicated everything will turn out to be when we get to grips with it. Yeah. We're near the end of our allotted time, so I'd like to conclude, if I may, by asking, we've talked about some of the priorities for this line of research. What are your own personal future research plans?
Well, as I said before, I look at myself as a puzzle solver. So there are lots and lots of puzzles out there. You know, when someone is trying to understand how Mandarin Chinese works or how English works, then I think we can do experiments with children that control for certain factors. And so children are a good way to investigate and to sort of neutralize the pragmatics and the phonological properties and just hone in on the differences that have to do with logical reasoning and so on. So I do want to continue to work with children. But recently I've become interested in working with children who have language disorders as well. So we have a project at our center on specific language impairment. And specific language impairment is typically marked clinically in Indo-European languages by a failure to assign tense or agreement. So one thing that I'm interested in is, well, what happens in languages like Mandarin Chinese where tense and agreement are not marked, where there's a detailed articulated aspectual system, but you actually don't mark past tense and present tense and so on. You know, it's clear that there are many children who speak Mandarin Chinese who have specific language impairment, and yet, of course, they're not going to have the same clinical markers, the failures to deal with or difficulties in dealing, assigning tense and agreement to sentences. So one thing that I want to work on in the next few years is to find out what characterizes specific language impairment in languages like Mandarin Chinese. Why this is interesting for me is because if there is a notion of specific language impairment, and if it's characterized differently in Indo-European languages and in East Asian languages, then maybe we can find out really what specific language impairment is ultimately, what its cause is. It has to be at a level of abstraction that's higher than just aspect or tense and agreement. So we can learn more about human languages by studying these language disorders. But again, in order to study even language disorders, I think the real payoff for me is to study typologically distinct languages and see how language disorders unfold in different kinds of languages. Then when we have our hypotheses, we'll be positing structures and deficits at a far more abstract level than just the surface manifestations of these language impairments. So I want to work on more on Mandarin Chinese and English and other languages. Whatever my students want to work on, then I want to work on that as well. But I also would like to work more on language disorders and look at cross-linguistic disorders, how they play out in different languages.
Well, I very much agree. It's a fascinating project, and I look forward to reading more about the outcomes of that in years to come. For now, let me say, Stephen Crane, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Stephen Crane about his book, The Emergence of Meaning. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.